Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Hello. Today I'm going to read from the Good Old Days magazine, the March-April issue, and these will be articles about springtime. This one is entitled, Go Fly a Tiny Kite. His model airplane skills helped him create a winning kite. This was sent in by J. Bernie Dibble. In the 1930s, the little town of Rochelle, Illinois, celebrated Memorial Day with all kinds of activities in addition to the customary parade. There were baseball games, swimming races in Spring Lake, and so on. But one year, there was a kite-making and flying contest. Notices of the contest were all over town, in stores, on billboards, in the newspaper, with this attention-catching headline, Go Fly a Kite. This common expression usually means get out of here, or mind your own business, or quit bothering me. But in this case, it meant there were going to be prizes for the biggest kite, the prettiest kite, the highest flying kite, and the winners in several other categories. All the kites had to fly, no matter their other attributes. But the category I was interested in was making and flying the smallest kite. One of my indoor hobbies was building model airplanes. I didn't build solid models, but the kind that were light and flyable, made of balsa wood and tissue paper. Model kits with a 12-inch wingspan were 10 cents, and the 18-inch ones were 25 cents. This was my procedure. First, I thumbtacked the plans on a breadboard and then covered them with wax paper. Next, I pinned the sticks from the kit to the plans, and with banana oil fast-fixing glue, I built the fuselage, wings, rudder, and stabilizers. Then I covered all the parts with tissue paper and sprayed them with water from my mother's atomizer, which shrank the paper to make it taut when it was dried. Finally, I assembled the various sections. The propeller was rubber band powered. Some of the models I put together actually flew. When I was through playing with them, I hung them from the ceiling of my room. When I got tired of them, I flew them out the window of my room and watched them crash in the garden. So, for the kite contest, I got to work using the skills I had developed with the airplanes. I built my kite out of balsa sticks and tissue paper. It was about 6 inches long and 4 inches wide. I knew that the main horizontal spar had to be curved, so I borrowed a round bottom bowl from the kitchen, carefully bent a 4-inch length of balsa around it, painted it with special model lacquer, let it dry, and voila, I had a curved spar. I glued the longitudinal spar to it. I used thread from my mother's sewing kit to form the outside borders, and then I laid tissue paper over it, gluing it to the spars and thread borders. Then I sprayed it with water and let it shrink while it dried. After it dried, I tied a tiny little ribbon on the kite for the tail and used a spool of my mother's sewing thread for the flying string. I tested it in the alley between our house and the church. There wasn't much wind there, so I ran with it. It actually flew and stayed up as long as I ran with it. I was ready. The great day finally came. I was a bit in awe as I saw all the older boys with their big or pretty or unusually shaped kites. But I also noticed that my kite was by far the smallest one in the lineup of little ones. Now, if it would only fly and stay up. My turn came. There was a nice breeze that took my kite up and up and up. I don't remember how long it had to fly to qualify, but whatever that amount of time was, I met the criterion and I won the contest. I don't even remember what the prize was. It was probably a real kite. This item was entitled Go Fly a Tiny Kite, sent in by J. Bernie Dibble. This next story is entitled Backyard Adventures. All that he needed was a little imagination. This was written and sent in by John Scanlon. In 1967, I was 8 years old and the eldest of four boys living in Stoutsville, Ohio. This tiny dot on the map was located 30 miles south of Columbus and didn't even have a stoplight. Just a restaurant, a bank, and an IGA grocery store downtown, near where railroad tracks cross Main Street. But Stoutsville certainly had no lack of adventure. There, in our backyard, and with my and my brother's imaginations, anything could happen. Lording over the backyard was our Sears Ranger Tower. From way up there, we could see forever, even all the way back to the tiny stream that passed in front of the Stoutsville Cemetery. Should zombies ever arise from their graves and attempt to cross those raging waters, they would easily be detected. Then we could slide down the Ranger Tower's emergency deployment pole like firemen and commence an immediate counterattack. There was also a vast sandy desert that spread out before the bottom of the Ranger Tower. It was a protective buffer littered with abandoned enemy trucks that had tried to cross the barren wasteland only to break down in the heat. The white garage was our bunker command center. It was made of indestructible concrete blocks, and all of our secret missions were planned within its confines. Bandit the Wonder Dog slept in the command center, keeping one eye open to guard our communications equipment and supersonic bicycles. Behind the command center, Dad's brown work truck was tied to the pier. He was employed by the Julian Spear Company, heating and air conditioning contractors, which was painted on the side of the hull. You see, that truck was really my PT-109. As young Navy Lieutenant John F. Kennedy, I manned the helm, standing behind the truck's cab and observing forward over the top. Dad's tool bins on the right and left sides contained my torpedoes, and a machine gun was mounted on the hood. Waves would splash over the front bumper as I patrolled the Pacific for Japanese submarines and destroyers. Television? I didn't need it. Computer games? I wouldn't have played them. In 1967, my imagination was all I needed. And this was entitled Backyard Adventures by John Scanlon. And I hope you understand that it was all written as though the little guy was actually out on the sea when he was just in his backyard. This next story is entitled The Canine Mayor of Port Byron. Trusty Jiff could be counted on to perform several errands around town. This story was written and sent in by Andrea Mann. No one knew how big he would get or exactly how old he was, not the people at the pound nor the vet, but he was clearly still a puppy. In the spring of 1969, my father and brother were tasked by my mother to deposit a stray cat at the local pound. Those instructions did not include trading in the cat for a dog. We named him Jiff after the peanut butter. He grew into a dandy, proud, and confident dog, the canine mayor of our small town in upstate New York. He trotted the streets confidently in the time before leash laws, enjoyed pats on the head, and followed every kid who had a candy bar or a popsicle. Everyone knew Jiff. My father was the proprietor of a lumberyard business and gas station in the center of town, and Jiff created a job for himself by volunteering to lounge by the entrance and greet every customer that entered when he wasn't out surveilling the village. There was an intelligence within Jiff that seemed to transcend the limits of his canine brain. Dad saw it and took advantage of Jiff's drive to please. Every afternoon, Dad and Jiff would walk across the street and a half block down to the Marine Midland Bank to deposit the day's revenue. Barbara, the teller, always had a treat for Jiff and would hand it over when Jiff sprang from his haunches and put his paws on the counter. After several trips, Dad had an idea. If Jiff could get the deposit to the bank on his own, that would free up time to close shop for the day. And that's exactly what happened. Picture a brown and white mutt with an intent and focused look in his eyes and a zippered money pouch attached to his collar, trotting down the street as if he were delivering a telegram from the president. Jiff never became distracted, even by the many squirrels who lived on our elm-lined streets. He had a job to do and a treat waiting for him inside the bank. Dad wisely kept an eye on him until he pawed at the bank door and was let in. Barbara was waiting and traded Jiff the deposit for a tasty biscuit and a receipt, which she zipped into the money bag and reattached to Jiff's collar. This was a dog with a purpose, and he knew it. Eventually, Dad sent Jiff on errands to the post office, just a few doors away, to fetch stamps and the mail. Mr. Appleby had equally tasty treats to dole out to this canine executive assistant. Jiff faithfully carried out his duties to a ripe old age and earned himself a luxurious retirement home on the seat of Dad's pickup truck when he no longer had the energy to be the lumberyard greeter and errand boy. My brother and I still talk about Jiff all these years later. There are dogs that touch our hearts and leave lasting paw prints on our memories. I hope there's a dog heaven, and Jiff is there, delivering prayers to his fellow canines that we humans offer up for our best furry friends. And this was The Canine Mayor of Port Byron by Andrea Mann. Now, here's a story that's very appropriate for this week in the calendar. It's entitled, The Week of the Gowk. Some elaborate pranking helped her grow closer to her students. This was sent in by Marilyn Ludwig. I did not want to be tricked. The year 1968 was tricky enough without featuring me as the brunt of an April Fool's Day prank. And I was gullible enough to fall victim to every joke, every single time. My third grader's eyes were filled with mischief and wicked plans for their teacher, me. My husband of only 2 years and I had been separated by the Vietnam War. I was back with my parents and teaching in North Caldwell, New Jersey. The times were turbulent, the news reports filled with fear, protests, riots, and death. Perhaps my students reflected our adult fears, for they were especially challenging. As for me, I was not happy with myself. Barring being a total coward and calling in sick, I needed to form a plan to protect myself. What if I were the trickster? What if I kept them so confused they wouldn't even think about trying to fool me? Suddenly, I remembered something amusing from my studies of Scottish folklore. The Day of the Gowk, or sometimes called Hunt the Gowk, a two-day observance, is Scotland's version of April Fool's Day. The Gowkie is a cuckoo bird that causes havoc each April. My Gowkie would make itself known for a full week by starting early before April 1st. My students might not suspect I was the fooler and would be so distracted they would forget about their own plans to play pranks on me. The teacher's room was right across the hall from my classroom. I planned to ask the other teachers to help whenever they had free periods and when my students were out of the room. Since I would miss my free periods when I stayed with my class during recess, music, art, and gym, it would be a hard week, but it would be worth it. I giggled in anticipation. Just having a plan of attack improved my disposition. Day 1, afternoon, Monday, March 25th. We returned from music class and found the room in total shambles. Contents of desks on the floor, chairs turned upside down, a note on the blackboard. Dear third graders, I searched everywhere for this week's spelling words. When I couldn't find them, I got mad. That sometimes happens when things don't go my way. Are you like that too? Please make copies of the spelling list in your best cursive writing and leave them on the back table. I am trying to become a better speller. The neatest list will earn a star. Please tell your teacher I'm sorry for the mess and help her clean up. Your friend, Gowkie. Following the signature on the note with the drawing of a comical bird, I was certain the art teacher was responsible. The kids obeyed orders. As soon as the room was back in shape, they got to work on their lists. I closed the day by reading a story about Mrs. Pigglewiggle curing children of leaving their bedrooms messy. The children gathered around me on the rug with one little girl resting against my leg. I felt closer to them than I had all year. On the way home, I stopped at the stationer's and bought a box of large Silver Star stickers. Day 2, morning, Tuesday, March 26th. The children were thrilled to discover their papers adorned with silver stars on their desks. "The Galki knows where I sit," Adam shouted. I shook my head. "I don't think that's possible," I said. I took the seating chart home by mistake. They were smart kids. Why didn't they guess the Galki was me? Perhaps they were caught up in the fantasy. I know I was. This time, the message on the board was in cursive. They struggled to read it. "Dear third graders, all of your papers were beautiful. Each of you earned a star. You must have worked very hard. I know you are busy, but if you have time, please draw me something to make me laugh. Your friend, Galki." A new comical cuckoo drawing followed this note. The children looked hopefully at me. "Sorry," I said. "We can't fall behind on learning our times tables. You'll have art this afternoon. Perhaps your teacher will help you." That was most likely her plan, for many of the papers that resulted were cartoons of the cuckoo. The days continued. Sometimes the Galki was pleased, sometimes not. Whenever it was upset, we formed cleanup committees. It always apologized profusely the next day. The teachers were having a ball with their tricks and because of observations of my students in various locales. I was getting to know them better and becoming more confident in being their teacher. I was plenty tired when the weekend came, though. Monday, April 1st, the last day. Other than the farewell message on the board, the activities that day were my doing. A frozen orange juice can, covered with bright gift wrap, and containing a fake flower and a new pencil, graced each desktop. All of our lessons that day were turned into games, such as a spelling bee and math bingo. In order to bring out the cupcakes and lemonade I had made, I skipped gym class in the afternoon. The art teacher wrote the very last message when we were out of the room. "Dear third graders, I have loved spending the week with you. I hope I see you again someday. Your friend, Galki." I took a picture of the cuckoo drawing so we would have a souvenir. "Something to remember," I said. My goal had been accomplished, but I also received something I didn't expect. Somehow, during that week, joy and my sense of humor returned. Yes, it was late in the year, but my students and I had finally turned a corner. From that time until school ended in June, all was well. The following year was splendid. My husband fulfilled his military duty, and we were ready to start our married life again. The Galki, our April Fooler, never appeared again. Its job was done. And this was The Week of the Galk by Marilyn Ludwig. Now here is an item from the Bits and Pieces section of the Good Old Days magazine. This is entitled 5 Cent Lemon Drops and sent in by Mona Baria Leach. What an exciting day it was when my cousin Janet and I finally accumulated 5 cents for a treat that we had been saving for. Believe me, it was hard for us to save 5 cents in the 1950s when we barely had shoes that didn't have holes in the soles to wear to school. With our 5 pennies in hand, we headed to the candy counter that was located inside the Five and Dime store in Spring Hill, West Virginia. The store had good variety to choose from, but 5 cents was enough to get just what we wanted, lemon drops. Lemon drops were not only Janet's and my favorite candy. Our grandfather loved them, too. We would buy a whole brown paper penny candy bag full of lemon drops for just 5 cents. The candy in that bag would last for many days, even though we shared them with our grandfather. We would all sit on his back porch and pass the candy bag around to satisfy our sweet tooths. It might be funny to think that 5 cents could make two young girls so happy, but when everything was so hard to get, it made a lot of kids happy to have a nickel for the many different things you could buy at the five and dime. The nice lady at the candy counter was always happy to help us and never seemed bothered to ring up our purchases. Sometimes I think she might have added a few extra pieces just to be so very kind. Nowadays, there are stores that have everything you can ask for. I still walk down the candy aisle with all the different kinds of candy to choose from and put a prepackaged plastic bag of lemon drops in my cart. They cost more than a nickel now, but they're sure worth the price. I hope Cousin Janet still adds them to her grocery cart when she goes to the modern stores. The taste of the lemony candy always brings back a lot of fond memories for me. And this was 5 Cent Lemon Drops by Mona Baria Leach. And now from the Rewind section of the magazine, these items, things my parents used to say. When Linda Bray was learning how to drive and stopped at a red light, her mother passed along this helpful reminder. This car has only one set of eyes, and that's yours. Growing up in the 1930s, if Samuel Raymond's mother didn't get a response to a question, she would ask if there was nobody home or if someone was out to lunch. Well, that concludes today's broadcast. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.